upside down.
Is your microphone on this side?
Well, this is the one you put on the website. Your speech here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, last week's speech. Yeah. That doesn't mean that you can't, that doesn't mean you shouldn't come. That just means that it's on the website. Everybody has different learning skills. The kids get crazy from me because I listen to lectures in the car when I'm not talking to them. So I listen. So they say, "But you listened to that one already." Because I can listen several times to like pick up all of the nuances. So like they know all of the jokes that are in the tape, you know, whatever is in the tape. You know, they all know the jokes that the rabbi says, something like that. Say, "Oh, that's one we heard already." So I said, no, but tell me the rest of what he's saying, you know. Don't tell me the jokes. Tell me the rest of what he's saying. All right. I'd like us to focus on first, page 698. We're going to focus our attention, 698, verse 14. The background to this pasuk is, so that you understand how are we getting into a discussion of cheating, is because the Torah tells us that in the Jubilee year, all property returns to its original owner. In the Jubilee year, all property returns to its original owner. So therefore, remember, the land of Israel was divided based upon ancestral heritage. So therefore, depending upon your tribe, is how you inherited your land. And that was handed down from father to son in direct succession. And then from father to son, if there was a daughter, if there was no son at all, it would be handed down through the daughter. And if there was no inheritor, so then there were other rules involving. Almost never could you transfer property on a permanent basis. If you sold it, you only sold it until the Jubilee year.
That's the seventh year?
The 50th year.
15th year.
50.
Right.
Wow. But we'll talk about that. So now when you inherit it, when it goes every 50th year, it would go back. Now, let's say I sold property 10 years to the Jubilee.
How can it go back to the original owner? He's gone. Nobody is
around. Yeah. I apologize. I'm sorry. It goes back to the familial estate, meaning the children and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren.
Of the original owner.
Of the original owner. Meaning it's only 50. It's only 50 years. Meaning the maximum sale date. I apologize. Let me explain it. Try a different way. The maximum sale date that you could sell property is 49 years, because 49 years. Because basically, is if this year is Yovel, the Jubilee year, so next year, at the end of this year, the first day of the next year, I sell it to you. Now, really, I'm not selling it to you. In English terms, I would say I'm leasing you the property for 50 years. You can never lease somebody, right? Not going to all the legal laws, but conceptually, you basically could lease it for up to 50 years.
Is there something like to keep it?
Like always in the family. That's correct. Yes.
Like the covenant, like with the tribes and things like that. Yeah.
That is exactly correct. Yes. Yeah. The purpose was that land. There's two purposes to it. One is so that land remains, the heritage remains divided according to the categories of the tribes, by and large. The second is so that nobody should ever be destitute for eternity, if one wants to borrow concept, meaning land was, to a certain extent it still is, but land certainly was the key to a person maintaining their livelihood and their ability and their stability. You have land, especially in an agricultural society, but even in other societies, so therefore that made sure that even if a person had a moment of poverty in the family, that would ultimately at some point it would go back to that family and they would hopefully try again. And maybe I'll be able to make it a go this time. So that's one of the ideas of of land.
Isn't it important also to, this was very compelling for me, that the land belongs to Hashem.
Kili Kol Haaretz. Yes, you're correct. I should have quoted that. You're right. The basic idea also is that God owns the land. God owns everything. And Hashem ultimately wants it to be redesigned and reconfigured to match his plan of having the land distributed among the people. Right? And therefore, basically, is you're only allowed to do leasing. Right? Basically, the land, that's when the Jubilee year applies. When does the Jubilee year apply? It only applies so long as the great court is in session. When the temple was suspended, or around that time, not exactly the same time, but around the time that the temple was suspended, the great court, the Sanhedrin, the great court of the Jewish court was suspended, it was disbanded, and was not formed again, and will not be formed again until the Messianic era.
De facto, should we be generalizing these concepts? In other words, try to keep things within our family, remember
them? No. No, you don't find that, you don't find, sometimes concepts you could, but you don't find that the Jubilee year in its is practiced, but there are certain concepts that basically one would take from it.
I don't necessarily mean the Jubilee year, but just property, possessions, to keep it within your own family.
I don't see that that's been practiced, even in concept, brought down. I think it's also tied, remember, to the land of Israel having a certain sanctity and everybody having their share in the land of Israel. I did see something fascinating yesterday when I was studying. What happens? I always bother me. I never knew someone discussed it. What happens when the Mashiach comes? Okay, the Messiah is going to come. We're going to go back to Israel. Now, how are they going to divide the land? They're going to go look back through to 300 years ago and see whether, you know, the grandfathers, the great-great-great-great, I mean, and there are many questions that you could ask on that, because it won't really work if that was the way that was done. It always bothered me, because the reason it won't work is theoretically because most of the tribes, primarily today, most of the people alive today are from Judah and Benjamin. The other tribes are somewhere mixed in small numbers. But not Levi. I'm sorry. Yeah. So how's that going to work? Exactly.
Well,
I saw there's a Chazon Ish, one of the great rabbis of our time, the last 100 years. He has a long essay on this topic, and there he writes, and he brings proofs, and others bring proofs, that in the Mashiach, based on the pasuk in Yechezkel, that says the land will be redivided in the Messianic era. So just an interesting point, neither here nor there, just an interesting tidbit of information, that when the Mashiach comes, I'll be land. And I don't know the answer to your question, if you're going to ask me. Let's say a person bought land in the land of Israel today, right, in the state of Israel. Let's say somebody bought land, and the Mashiach comes, what happens to that land? So that I don't know. The Chazon Ish didn't. I don't know if he addressed. It could be that it will, it has to be taken into consideration. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I just want to covers, I apologize. That was just an introduction. That's not really what I wanted to discuss. That's, with that introduction of the 50 years, that's where the Torah introduces us to the concept of not cheating somebody in business. Why? Because if you know math, so you know the land is only going to be sold for 13 years. And you want to charge him an amount of 15 years. And you tell him, well, it's 15 years to the Jubilee year. Or you don't tell them anything, or you swindle them, whatever it is. So it's open to, it is an easy way to swindle somebody, right? And therefore, that's where the Torah tells us one may not cheat his brother. Meaning the cheating has nothing to do with whether the person knows about it. The cheating is you have the violation of the cheating, right? It's nothing to do with whether or not he sells it, or he buys it, or he's a sucker, or any of that. It solely has to do with your actions.
Well, actually, if you look at the Pasuk, we're really not buying land. You never bought land. You're buying either crops, or if you're, or in the case of a slave, you're buying so many years of work.
Labor, right.
So you're not buying the land. The land is always, because you don't own the land. We never owned the land. It was Hashem owned the land, and we were just the lessee. And our rent was, in effect, our adherence to the Torah. That was the rent we had to pay.
Very good.
If somebody would build a home in that land, can you build a home if you lease the land? Or is it just for crops?
Right, so that's a question. All of these questions are addressed. What are you allowed to do on the land? What are you not allowed to do on the land? the improvements of the soil, who does it go to when it transfers back? All of these questions are addressed in the laws of commerce, exactly what they would do. Is there ever a way to transfer land on a long-term basis? So all of these are technical laws that they discuss in terms of this. But building a house is a bigger issue than the others. So that's a question that they discuss. How could you build a house, or how would one go about, you know, that type? Is there a way to set up a system that you could have a longer than 50-year transfer, at least for the property that the house is sitting on? So I'm not an expert in that field, but there is discussion all of that. Okay. So the Torah tells us, Al tonu ish es achiv, a man should not cheat his brother. In verse 17, the Torah again says, Velo sonu ish es amiso, each man shall not aggrieve his fellow, and you shall fear your God, for I am Hashem, your God. We have a rule that any time it says you shall fear God, the reason that God says that is because it means it is open to self-interpretation. And any area that's open to self-interpretation requires the fear of God in its implementation. In English, you could always say, well, I didn't mean that, because this second verse we have, do not cheat man in business. Then we have, do not cheat your fellow man with your words, which is referring to that one should not hurt the feelings of another individual. It's extended into that area, and that I talked over Shabbos, but we're going to expand that a little bit. So we have a violation principle is not to say hurtful words to another individual. And there it says, you shall fear the Lord your God, for I am God. Right? Very interesting. Why does it say you shall fear the Lord your God? Because we all know that you could hurt somebody's feelings and say, oh, I didn't mean it, right? You could give all of excuses, because very often hurtful feelings, you cheat somebody. I mean, it's pretty straightforward in business, right? But in terms of hurtful words, so often that is dependent upon the eyes, that's dependent upon the intonation of the voice, right? And the person often could say, oh, I didn't mean it that way. Right, so often the only one that knows what you really meant is you and God. Right. Another idea behind this v'yireisim elokecha is that's how careful you need to be. Meaning, unfortunately, people are not careful enough in their choice of words. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz has an essay where he discusses that you are responsible even for unintentional hurt by your words. That's how far it goes. This biblical violation is even unintentional, or what we would call collateral damage from your words. You have great responsibility. So people say, you're just too sensitive. People have a tendency, they say, someone who gets their feelings, say, you're too sensitive. So a person has to be careful, right? Right. This is coming from the speaker standpoint. We'll talk about the listener in a minute, but let's talk about the speaker for a minute. So Chaim Shmulevitz used to give the expression, right? Right, and this idea is it's like lighting a forest fire. Right, if a person throws a match in the forest, only through a teeny little match, only a little cigarette, right, was that responsible for the whole fire? The answer is that's the nature of fire, it burns, it has unintentional consequences. He says, so too, words are very much like that. Words are very powerful, right, despite these famous lines, sticks and stones may break my bones, but that words may never hurt you. The only thing that usually hurts long term is words, right? Bones heal. Words can, the scars from words can remain indefinitely, right? So that's in terms of unintentional. Now, I will tell you a fascinating halacha in the laws of, interesting, where are the laws of hurting somebody's words, hurting somebody's feelings, where are they found? So there are four areas in Code of Jewish Law, broken into four sections. It's interesting, it's contained in the section of cheating in business. Right? Just like cheating in business, because it uses the expression of cheating, which we talked about yesterday in Shul, because it uses the expression of cheating, so these laws of hurting somebody's feelings with your words is contained in the laws of commerce, because it affects commerce as well. For example, a person is not allowed to walk into a store and ask, how much is this, when he has no intention of buying it. because you're creating a false expectation on the part of the owner. Right? You're creating a certain amount of excitement. You're creating the reason why he's giving you the service. Right? It would seem that it is problematic to go into stores and try on things when you're carrying your phone iApp and you're going to take a picture of the barcode and you're going to then say, oh, good, I could go buy it across the street for much cheaper. Right? That would seem to be forbidden.
If you haven't spoken
I don't know. Owner. I don't know if it's forbidden to walk into Target and take a picture of the barcode to see if you can get it cheaper elsewhere. There, it doesn't. I don't see how that would be forbidden, to be honest with you, because there the halacha of the cheating tends to be creating a false expectation in the conversation. Doesn't mean by walking into the store.
But you're also stealing it. Dennis Prager goes into a hole. He does a wonderful show on the shopkeeper's law, and he gets all these really egregious people to call, you know, what they do. Of course, you've heard that stuff. And they're paying the rent and the space and the business, so you're really going in. Depends on your intention. If you are allowed to go.
That's a society. See, you're right. I was debating that issue.
Yeah.
I didn't discuss this with any of the great rabbis. I don't know. But I don't know if that's a societal problem. Okay, I don't know if that's a technical legal term in terms of you cheated somebody.
There's a chance that you're going to buy it at Target. You can go in and look, and then you can decide. But the big thing is with the internet, with people going to buy it, or you know.
Right. I'll give you another question. Well, but I don't know. Did Dennis Prager ever discuss? I'll give you another case. This case is more common. Is can you go on? Can you surf the web and go to a site that has better layout structure? I mean, some of the sites are just better. They just are better. So I do all of my research on that site, let's say. And then I go back into my Google toolbar. I copy the barcode or whatever, you know, the identification. I push Google. And then I see, oh, that store, the Schmendrick store, has it for $10 cheaper. Meaning, so where does it begin and end, right, in terms of surfing? Now, there, it's hard to say that would be forbidden, because you say that also is called tonu, that's also called cheating the person because you're having a dialogue with his computer. So I don't know. I think that to a certain extent there is, and this is probably what I was going to say, there's a certain amount of accepted practice in terms of that is the way the business is conducted. The internet business is a cross the lines business. Everybody's banging against each other to see where it's going to lie.
It isn't not only accept, it's being in the business, it's sort of an anonymity of the person going in and checking. Of course, the person who owns the site, he doesn't know. All he knows are people coming to the site and how many buy. But he doesn't know specifically that you came there and that you checked it out and then went to another site. He would have no idea.
You're correct, but the prohibition is on me. It's not a question of whether you.
Yeah, but you're not hurting anybody. No one knows.
So
that it's could totally. Be,
yes, you are.
Why are you hurting someone if they don't know? And yes,
you are hurting because he's paid for the site. And every time it comes up there, that's one thing, one portion of his payment that he's paying for the site.
So, for example, that was another question. I'll give you. That raised another question I had. Can you click on. I'll tell you, let's say you see a click.
You have no idea you're doing it.
Can you use a click, a sponsored link on Google? That's another one of the questions I had. Meaning, I know I'm not going to buy from that sponsored link click, but he has to pay 4 cents or 20 cents. Yep. I don't know exactly how they work,
more.
But he has to pay a certain amount. Are you allowed to click on that sponsored link click?
But you know, the funny thing is, and by the way, Dennis Prager does not know what you know, or I don't even. Mean to imply that.
No, I was simply.
Right.
I wasn't asking whether Dennis Prager passed the law.
Right.
I was just asking you, does he discuss this problem?
He discussed the egregious ones, by the way, like people that go into car shopping and real estate. The two very big take a lot of time. You take up the time in weeks and months, and then, oh, I'm going to get it elsewhere. And people that return clothes to Macy's, and just all kinds of, you know, strange things. Yeah. But anyway, so I didn't mean to.
No. This is a big issue. Regarding the returns is a big problem. This issue with the returns. Can you buy something with the intention to return it? Because the store has a policy that you could return it. So there, I don't know what. Well, not I don't know. I mean, I don't really see 100% why that would be permitted. But I'll give you another. No, if it's effective, for sure. No. This question was, I'll give you the case. I'm going to change the case. Somebody presented me the following case. They went on vacation. No, they went on vacation, and they wanted a TV on vacation. But they want, no, I'll give you a better one. They wanted a GPS. They wanted a GPS for vacation. They're going on vacation. So they went to Costco. They bought a GPS. They used it for 2 weeks. Vacation was over. Bring it back.
That's wrong.
There was never an intention for the purpose of the item. What you really were doing is you were leasing the item or renting the item, and happens to have been that you don't pay any rent for it. But that's what you did. But this store is not in the leasing business. Right? So therefore, that's why I didn't feel. I told them, so the person went to the store. So I said, it's a true story. I changed a little bit the details, but what the person is, they told me that they asked in Costco, and Costco said that they have an unlimited, unconditional return policy, and therefore you're allowed to do it.
They changed it.
So I told them back on the electronics they changed it, but I told them that there's no chance that Costco can have, I says, their policy of the unconditional return is in order to increase your likelihood of buying. But I said, if you're purchasing an item with never having a decision of buying, so you never bought it. So I said, then it would be stealing. But a lot of these issues is you have to be honest. The problem is people are not honest with themselves. We said to be honest with themselves. In general, the rule of thumb is that you should try to be stricter in the area of financial. One should try their best to be as strict as possible with oneself so one never comes to the chance of cheating. In terms of, I will tell you a piece of information that you should know, worthless interruption of our class, but something you should know. There is on your credit cards, almost everybody's credit card has it, you have buyer protection. It's one of these insurances that you never even know you have on your card, but they boast about it all over, but you have no idea how to use it. So it says there that if you buy something, you have 90 days. If it breaks for any reason, you have 90 days to give it back, to get your money back. Right? So if the store won't take that day, you're going to return it. So I bought a cell phone for my mother. She should live and be well. And I said to the phone, so about 80 days later, she calls me almost crying, right, that she dropped the phone in the water, which to us is normal. But to my mother, she took it rather seriously. She had a relationship with the phone. And
your daughter's on my phone as we speak.
She did it. So she dropped it in the water, Nebuch. And I said, she was very upset, very, very, very upset. So I said, Ma, it's just a phone. Okay? And I get carried away. It's a phone. It happens. So you get a new one. So I'll send a new one tomorrow. So, of course, I ordered her a new one. Meanwhile, no good deed goes unpunished. They sent her a new one. I'm not sure exactly what happened. They sent her a new used one. So they sent her it with all of the contacts of the other person on it. So, of course, needless to say.
That's terrible.
So, well, it was terrible if you were the son of the mother. But I won't tell you what the mother said to the son. But in any case, the mother was happy with the son, because the funny story was, this woman, I remember, you know, there's something called like this protection. How does this work exactly? So I called up Amex, and this is, so I look it up, yeah. So I filed the claim, just as you know, I filed the claim. I said, straight, we dropped a phone in the water by mistake, right? The next day, they had put the money back in my account. Unbelievable. The next day, they didn't. Even, they said they're going to get back to me. They're going to investigate the case, etc. By the morning, they had already responded that the money is in your account. So just as you know, okay, that worthless thing. But in any case, it's a piece of information. No. So if you're going to drop your phone in water, please do it within 90 days. That's the moral of the story.
And also extend your warranty like one
for an extra year.
Legitimately.
Yeah.
Really,
yes. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, you're better off breaking your camera in the second year. Because I've done that, not intentionally, but you're better off breaking your camera yourself, because your first year you have to go through the warranty company of the manufacturer, which is hopeless.
Yeah, I learned
the second year.
The second year it goes through your credit card company.
It's a very complicated difference between a credit card and a charge card. Right. Amex is one and the other one's the other.
Okay, so I'm very happy that I interrupted you. Okay, I'm very sorry to have interrupted this.
I got to get back to the thing with the internet. I'm a businessman. I have a warehouse. I need equipment for my warehouse.
I needed a pallet jack. I went online. Pallet jacks went from $199 to $2,000. I went all over the place.
Right. So the internet, I don't think anybody would say, just to close, I don't think anybody would say.
That was the word I was going to use before.
I don't think anybody would say. No, my case was, I'll tell you my case, where I'm troubled. As long as you're comparison shopping, nobody would say that you're not, it's forbidden. Because that's clearly business. Okay, the problem that I had, the question that I have, and I'm not saying it's forbidden. I don't believe it's forbidden. I want to be honest with you. I don't think it's forbidden on the internet. I don't think that you could say that that type of a public playing field is the nature of the beast, and that is the nature of how it was designed to be. But the question that I had was, is I know that this site always charges 20% more for their items. I'm creating a hypothetical, always, okay? But they have the best layout reviews. They have all of the reviews there. They have all of the information there, etc. The marketing is better. They're putting more money into their internet site in order, whereas the other site is the junkiest site. You can hardly get to the buy button, but it's $10 cheaper or $100 cheaper. Right, so then that was where my question was. As long as you're investigating, so it's not. But in any case, I did not mean to say that that's forbidden. I understand the internet to be, that is the nature of the way it was designed, and that they're hoping, right, that you're going to cut the sale. The same thing going into Target. I think that Target, the goal is that once you go in, hopefully you're going to buy it. So you're right, Jim. You know, there are certain people, you know, that are going, that would be seen. The car, I will tell you by the car, now that we're on this topic. So there, I cannot, there, when I went to the car dealer, right, so if it's, you know, I told him, I'm looking around, I look at the car, if you could stay within reason of the prices around the area, right, which I gave is within $500. If you could stay within $500, it's worth it for me to buy the car here. So he understood exactly what we were talking about. Right, we discussed. We went through the car. The interesting thing is that they never followed up. They never followed up. So I kept calling the place. So finally, I learned that the guy had quit. So then I didn't bother to pursue it. They didn't call me back. So then already I didn't pursue it to go find it. The new guy, etc., you know, etc. But it was an interesting experience. But there is, I told him straight, and that there has to be some amount of ability, but there's no question that the mortar and brick store, brick and mortar, has to have the ability to compete. So there has to be a certain amount of fairness in it, right? You can't go into a bookstore, read all of their books, and then go home and buy them on the internet, right? That also would be a certain amount. Where you're going into Barnes & Noble with no intention of buying any of them, you're just sitting out your paper and you're writing down all of the books that you're going to buy at home on the internet for 30% cheaper. That would be a problem. That
but clearly would be a problem. I understand what you're saying. You haven't spoken to a commissioned person who is.
You're correct. So you're correct. I don't know if it would be the idea of the getting the false hopes of the person, but I don't know if constantly making yourself into a person. I don't know. You're right. You're right. It may not violate the onas devarim aspect of it, the cheating with words aspect of it, but I don't know if. You know, when we're partner to creating an entire society which cannot sustain itself, whether that's the so exactly, you're right. It would not violate, looking at the book would not violate the onas devarim. Onas devarim is very
painful. There's a stumbling block in front of somebody that's blind. So right. In that case, then you'd be putting something on
somebody. I mean, it could be that it violates a different idea of love your neighbor like yourself. It's interesting, in the Ram, one of the Svarim, the Chafetz Chaim writes this, that certain things goes into do not do unto others what you wouldn't want unto yourself. Right? So to a certain extent, you know, you have to ask yourself what's reasonable. Right? To a certain extent, there's a certain amount of of reasonable logic that has to apply in a lot of this, to where the lines are. But they are you know, there is a certain amount of technical law and a certain amount of gray. I did want to add, very fascinating, the Gemara gives several examples of painting somebody with words. One is asking a storekeeper how much this is when you have no intention of buying it whatsoever. Another is where you remind a person of his past, let's say a person had a not such a nice past, right? He was involved in gangs. I don't know. So you ask him, oh, how's all your buddy? Now the person did repentance and he's 30 years old. How's all your buddies from the gangs? Right? And you say it so that to embarrass the guy, either to even in private. Right? You send him back, right, in time. You remind the person, right, you know, you were once an idol. You know, any example, the Gemara's example, right? But interesting, I was learning, this everybody should know. Unbelievable thing, and you're going to hear this from me. In preparing, so I saw a lessons on painting with words. I saw something I never seen before. Unbelievable. This is it. It was worth it to come today just for this. Maybe for the price protection idea too, but besides it, right? But it's spiritually. Right, what I'm going to share with you, and this is something to share with everybody. In one of the Sfarim, it writes, one of the holy books, it writes, that this idea of raising one's past, right, of, you know, raising one's past, yeah, don't you remember you were in the gang someday, you know, now you're a big shot. I remember when you were nothing. I remember when you were shoplifting or whatever. Right, that's one. But it says there that an extension of this is that, let's say you have a friend, right? And you did something wrong to the friend. You hurt their feelings. You hurt the friend's feelings, right? Right? You hurt the friend's feelings. You called them a nickname that you shouldn't have called them, right? You told them a fatso or something like that. You hurt the person's feelings. So you come over late and you feel terrible. You should not have said that. You realize it was wrong, right? Then you go over to the person and you ask him, genuinely, you ask them for forgiveness. It's Yom Kippur, you ask them for forgiveness. Right, and the person sees the genuineness of your words, and the person says, I forgive you. Right, 2 months later, you see the person, you're in the conversation with them, and they remind you, remember you called me fatso? Right, or you see the person still bears a grudge on it, where there was genuine, right, there was a thing, the halacha is, the law is, once a person asks forgiveness and that dialogue has taken place, it is a violation of this principle to raise that issue again. Wow. It's fascinating. I did not see this anywhere till I'm very... This alone was worth coming. This alone was worth all of my learning. Right? I had not seen this anywhere else till the learning. Unbelievable. That just like painting somebody... I mean, it's obvious. Once I studied it, it was obvious. But I never saw connected the dots between the two points. That once the person forgives already, right, once that dialogue has taken place, because that's sending you back earlier in time to where a person cannot go anymore, just like reminding a person, right, he was once a thief, is forbidden, right, once he does tshuva to God, so to reminding of an offense that took place, once the dialogue of forgiveness and reconciliation has taken place, will be a violation of this principle of ono'as devarim. It's a fascinating of painting somebody with your words. Normally we look at it, right? So bearing a grudge, as long as the grudge is internal, so that's a violation of lo titar, which is a violation. You shall not hold a grudge. That's one violation. This is the second point. This is expressing it in words would be the violation of ono'as devarim, of painting somebody with your words. So it's a fascinating, fascinating insight, and one that we all should be aware of. And one that you know really needs to be spread around.
Is it a Gemara statement or is it?
Onas Devarim is in the pasuk. Onas Devarim is a pasuk in the Torah. Yeah. You shall not. Then it's brought down. Painting somebody with your words is the pasuk I just read to you, right? All of this, the Gemara says, the case reminding a person of their past. What I had never thought of. It could be in my own lack of thinking. Right? I never thought of it in this context. Of reminding somebody of their past is where they offended you, right? But where you've already had the dialogue of reconciliation, then it would be a violation of this principle to bring that up. Unbelievable idea.
Quick question. That was really great, by the way. Can you bring up the time of a Baal Tshuva's life before they were observant?
That's the case. That no, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to bring it up where... Well, it depends what your reasoning is. And this is where it comes to, you shall fear God. If you're bringing it up in order to show his greatness, then it would be permitted. Meaning, look at this. Could you imagine Do you know that Akiva, Rabbi Akiva, right, the famous Rabbi Akiva, right, for 40 years he didn't learn Torah, and I didn't learn Torah, right? He said that if he would have met a rabbi in his first 40 years, he would have broken his every bone of his body. That's how much he despised the rabbis. Right? So you say, you know, so you say, not violent, because you're trying to express his greatness. Right? So it depends on why you're bringing up the person's past.
If it's indifferent, like my brother, when we were growing up, but then...
If it lowers his esteem in the person you're having the conversation with, it would be a problem. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't lower the esteem, or it raises the esteem, if it's indifferent, meaning flatline, it would not be a problem.
Right. How do you know what the person's going to feel?
It right. really depends. You're right. correct. It really depends. It really depends on the person that... It really depends on the person you're having the dialogue with. You have to err on the side of caution, but it depends. It really would depend on the context and community. Right? In Calabasas, it doesn't do it. It raises the admiration of people. In other communities, it might not have that same
right,
net effect.
It converts with everybody. I mean, it
That's
just
correct.
Comes up all the time.
That's correct. It really would depend on the context and the community. You know, where... And the context of what you're trying to say, you know, see in it's funny in these laws it depends on body language. So last night I was reading when I was taking my break, so I can't read Torah. So I was reading this book, Teenage Guide to Seven Principles. So over there he has in dialogue. So he's talking about that 7% of our dialogue takes place in using language, words. He says 93% is basically body language and feeling and communication and other means. Right, only 7%. That's what I said. Right, I had the same question. I was like, 7%. That's a little bit. But okay, let's say it's 50%. It doesn't matter. The numbers don't make a difference. Right, but the idea. Right, so too, hurting somebody's feelings. Right, if you roll your eyes at somebody, right, that also is a violation of painting somebody with your words. Right, you know that would also be a violation of painting somebody with words. Right, interesting. We saw Salanter famous that one has to work on themselves. That when you're walking, you walk with a smile. Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, the great Mashgiach. Said over an expression that your face is a bor b'rishus harabim, is a pit in the public thoroughfare. I mean, what is a pit? If you dig a pit and you in the public, right, what happens? Or a pothole, your car goes in the pothole, right? So too, your face is a pothole. If you have a down face, everybody that sees you is going to be down. If you have an up face, everybody sees you is going to be up. Right, so it's called a public. It's a public nuisance. Right, you have no right. Right, there's a story with Rabbi Saul Salanter, one of the great ethicists of the Jewish people, and the greatest rabbis to have lived in the 1700s. So he was once walking, and he saw somebody's face was very drawn. So he ran over to him to what's wrong? He says, your family not well, health, wealth, something. He says, no, Rabbi, everything's good. So he says, why do you look so drawn? So he says, the Rebbe doesn't know. Next week is Rosh Hashanah. It's Yom Kippur. We're going to stand before God in judgment. So we still tell him, he says, the fact that you're going to stand before God in judgment means I have to suffer. Right? Right? We don't realize that, you know, it's unbelievable. You see somebody in the street smiling, you smile along with him. Mm-hmm. It's human nature. You smile. You see somebody drawn, right? A true story. A guy told me, somebody told me, he was walking in the park, you know, near Yeshiva. And he was walking, not with such a smiling face. So he's like, so one of the guys, one of the, a black and the community was walking by him, right? Right. You know, so he comes over to him and he says, "Hey, man, it ain't so bad." He goes and he's like, "Hey, man, it ain't so bad." So he says he came back to yeshiva. Right, that became the famous mantra. Right. So this person, we never knew who the black was to give him credit, but this thing, everybody in yeshiva, learned that from that person in the park. We all learned this lesson of smiling. Hey, man, it ain't so bad. I mean, we have a tendency, the world is coming to an end. Right? We have a tendency. Oh, you said that.
What?
Right. Nah, Neil sees the billboards.
Take
right?
it home.
Right.
Rabbi, and again, Dennis does the show to the public, to get these ideas to the public about happiness being a moral obligation. That a person's bad mood is like body odor, like on the supermarket line or something. He says it's a moral obligation to, you know, put a smile on your face and be happy. And then, of course, all the callers say, well, you know, are you supposed to be fake? And I mean, he goes into all of that. But that's what he talks about happiness.
Right.
And
fantastic,
that.
Fantastic. I'll share with you a story that will change you, and I'm sure Bezvat Hashem you'll hear it again at another time. Right? We talked so far, but we saw the Alter Slabot Kibnosen Tzvi Finkel talks about it, right? That your face is a pit in the public thoroughfare, and you have to be conscious of that. You basically, you're creating a public nuisance by having a drawn face, right? Push your face upward, give a smile to everybody. Rabbi Sol Salanter, right? You know, that I have to suffer because you're going to face God and judge me. Yeah. Rabbi Avram Gridzansky, right, was in the Warsaw ghetto, the Slobodka ghetto, in the Slobodka ghetto. And the Germans, obviously, as you know, they were annihilating, you know, as they were closing the camp. So Rabbi von Gazansky had worked on himself for 2 years prior to this. He had worked on this idea of greeting everybody with a smile. Always, he would greet everybody with a smile. So the handful of people that survived the ghetto, he was murdered. In the ghetto, but the handful of people that survived said over that even in the last days, when he would be walking in the street, he still had a smile, when he was greeting everybody, lifting people up in their last moments of life.
Oh my gosh.
Right, that's already at a different level, right? But, you know, right? You know that you can learn from him, right? If he did it then, right, we could surely do it, right? And, you know, many times, you know, this is really, we have to work on ourselves, right? Right, A, to realize that, you know, it's not necessarily as bad. And even if it is, right, it's probably not as bad as it was in Slobodka ghetto. No matter how difficult it is, it's probably not as bad as the Slobodka ghetto. Right? And if he could put on a smile, right, you have to put on a smile. Right? That's your personal responsibility. It's not fake. See, the answer, I believe, to the question is, what do you mean? But it's not fake.
Right.
That's what you're supposed to pervade, that type of, it's not fake to others, that's what you're supposed to pervade. You're supposed to pervade a certain amount of, right, you know, a certain calmness, a certain amount of serenity, a certain amount of peace, a certain amount of happiness and joy that I'm living, I'm breathing.
Right?
Right? I'm breathing. So one, there's one up on the person who's not. I mean, that idea that there's a certain amount of another idea, if you're getting stuck on how to do this, right, one trick that is that look at people that are waiters, right? Generally, right, waiters, you come in, they smile, right? There are some airlines that the stewardesses or the stewards smile. It depends which airline you're flying. It really depends on the airline. Some airlines, they do not have to smile. It's not in their contract, and the union does not require it of them.
And
right?
Anyway.
And you understand when you're on those airlines that was not part of the culture. You know, there are certain jobs that you see people smile, right? So think about it like this. If you're having trouble, right, smiling, right, if I come over to you and I offer you $10 to smile, you're going to smile?
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you 10 bucks. Probably you're going to smile. If not 100 bucks, you're probably surely going to smile. Right? Right? So think of it. Think of it every time. You know, feel that you're getting $10. You put on a smile now, get $10. Right? Or have candies in your... Every time you smile at somebody, you take a candy. But you have tricks to get yourself in the training mode of smiling, right? Right? If you smile at the world will smile back at you.
There's physiological research that when you smile, you do something lasting to your brain chemistry.
Yes, right.
So it has positive physiological
effects. The sun turns up.
Except if you're in Calabasas. When you're walking, I walk a couple times a week, you know, for exercise. It's amazing how many people you'll see on the street, they just look right by you. You can smile, you could do a dance, either that or they're looking down at the ground. But you know?
Usually, I speak very loud.
It's amazing.
I say, people by now know when they cross me, I say hello to everybody. Right? Sometimes they say, good Shabbos back. I usually say hello, and then they answer, good Shabbos. That's usually what happens. But I try to make a point. Sometimes you have people lost in their earphones.
Yeah.
Right? So, but usually I try to make sure that you connect with them, to try to train them. Usually what you have to do is you have to train them once. Usually once I train them once, usually then they communicate after that.
That rabbi, let's cross the street.
Right, that's true.
Right.
There's only sidewalks on one side in Keller, you know, nobody goes. But yes, it is an issue, yeah. In the city, it's almost hopeless, to be honest with you. In Calabasas, you could do it. In the city, it's almost hopeless to try to say hello to people. Right, it's almost hopeless.
Everybody that we walked by said good Shabbos.
I was talking about non-Jews. I was talking about non-Jews.
I wasn't in the area of non-Jews.
I was talking about during the week. You're talking about a different thing. I'm talking about during the week, right, in the morning.
Oh, secular.
I'm talking about secular. When I'm walking on the streets, there's no communication at all.
Well,
meaning it's not in Calabasas.
Well, you smile generally, people...
Correct, right. Right. So I tried that.
Smiles
when you cross, but people don't say good morning.
You still do it
for sure.
Amazing.
Yeah, I do. I try very hard to do it. I try at least to make the eye contact. A lot of times the problem is I'm on the phone. To be honest with you, a lot of times I'm on the phone. Right? So what I try to do is I try to make at least the eye contact with people. But people there, I find 100% of the time look down.
Yeah.
100% of the time. In Calabasas, at least I get some. Usually I can get some. In the city, you get zero. Right? People will look, you know, it's like they walk straight into the telephone pole. Yeah. They should see something. Okay. Another issue, another extension of hurting people's feelings is it extends to everybody. And we have to try to be sensitive to this. The natural tendency is that we tend to hurt the people furthest from us or the people we're the most careful with. And that's actually the biggest mistake,
yeah.
Right? And the closer the person is to you, the more careful one needs to be with their words. Moshe Aaron Stern uses our mouth is like a gun, right? Once you shoot the bullet, you can't bring it back. Right, as long as the bullet remains in the gun, you're in control. But once you pull the trigger, right, there's nothing you can do once you pull the trigger.
Pull the backfire.
Hence the song: "You only hurt the ones you love."
Right. So this is an issue that we have to recognize. We have to be careful, but it applies in all areas, right? It says, "Hochiach tochiach hasem isechav lo sisa lavchet," that you shall rebuke your neighbor. And you shall not carry upon him a sin. So one of the ideas behind this of rebuke is that you can't, by your rebuke, it can't be that you create a condition of sin where you're embarrassing the person by your rebuke, right? You're hurting the person's feelings by your rebuke. It has to be that it uplifts the person. It lifts up the person, right? And raises him on a pedestal, right? The person realizes how they can grow, and that's what your intention is. So therefore, it's very rare, if ever, that a person should offer words of criticism in a public venue, right? Because most often, if you can offer criticism in a public venue, the natural reaction is that the person gets embarrassed, or the natural reaction is the person counters or rejects it. And therefore, it's far more... the mitzvah would be to do it in a time where it will be accepted. It says that one of the altar we spoke about earlier, he would only give mussar often 2 weeks later. If his children did something, I don't think he means a 3-year-old, but he would wait till he was totally calm, till the situation had passed already, and then he would raise the issue like you're having a dialogue, right? Like you're having a dialogue in a private conversation. So that there's no intensity of the emotions, right? When something's happening, right, you know, there's a much greater tendency, right, to lash out, right? You have a tendency, we all have a tendency to say words that, to the extent that we didn't necessarily mean it, right? And then you create that intense, you know, firefight.
Could you just cite that law again about rebuke?
That you cannot say rebuke to somebody. This is brought in the Gemara. You cannot say rebuke to a person where A, it'll be rejected, or B, it'll create hurt feelings by the party. So you have to find a way to communicate it at a time where there won't be a natural hurt feelings.
Also, the same way, same basis, if you want to strike your child, you got to think, you know, it's going to happen if I strike your child.
Right. Yeah. Right. The spanking should never be a reaction. It should always be an action. Meaning, as you calculate it, this is the response that's necessary. Right. This is what's necessary. Right. So it always has to be that you're in control. Right. In Judaism in general, that's really the modus operandi. You have to be the person in control. No one else can ever be. Right. You have to always be. The Rambam describes anger. Anger is never appropriate. Right. Says the Rambam, internal anger is never appropriate. External anger, at times, is necessary. I mean, sometimes you have to display that you're intensely dissatisfied, right? But internally, you have to be totally calm, right? Whereas often, it's the opposite. A person is angry on the inside. A person's acting, because when you're angry, it's as if a person who's angry, it's as if he doesn't have a God. Right? What does that mean? Because when you're angry, you're not in control. Right? That has no place. A person always has to be in control. Right? Person's angry. It doesn't mean a person can't get angry. It means you can't talk out when you're angry. So a person can't get angry. Get angry is a natural phenomenon. You need to work on yourself to calm down. Right? And then and only after you're totally calm would one be able to begin the dialogue. But as long as you're upset, right, you shouldn't be in the dialogue. You shouldn't be in a conversation.
But you can get angry internally, be angry, and then you just work with
the Rambam said, the goal, because the Rambam can't tell you you cannot get angry. That's an impossibility. You need to be able to recognize that you take it in and you filter it out before you then open up yourself to anything. Right. Right. But the Rambam saying is that you can't react in anger. Right. I mean, the goal is not to get angry. But
I have tried that 2 weeks later to bring up something, and they go, first of all, they don't remember. Or they go, you bring in all things today.
Okay, so it depends like this. Once you have that, that's where it's important. No, it doesn't make a difference. This is the power of communication. Meaning is that in this practice, right, this types of mirroring, we have a dialogue, right, that takes practice. Meaning is that how do you have a dialogue of something that passed without becoming obsessed on the past, right? So that takes a proper, you know, you need coaching on that because it's a very, very important skill to develop. Mm-hmm. But you want to, that it's a skill that creates a, but the goal of all dialogue is to create is to enhance the relationship. So you have to have the skill, right, of practice of this communication, meaning you raise the point, but once you've raised it and you've settled it, right, then it can't be rehashed. That's what we talked about earlier. That a person has to talk about something, talk it through, understand the feelings of both parties, right, and understand the issue. Sometimes the answer is sometimes, honestly, you come up is that, okay, you have the right to agree gives the right to disagree. Not every issue is going to be resolved in a perfect form. You have to, you know what I mean?
That's better, because then you can bring it up again to the person.
Oh, there you go. You'll find a way.
See, you don't want to get forgiven, because then you get...
that's an issue, by the way. The issue is that the person that doesn't want to forgive, this is serious, we talked about it in the shul a few times already. There are some people that don't like to forgive, because they like to hold things up on somebody. My Rebbe said he never liked the expression, ein bad ma. There's an expression as you say thank you to somebody, you say, no, don't mention it. Right? I remember he gave a lecture and I didn't understand what he was saying till later. I didn't understand. He was very upset about it. He felt that those words are, the goal of those words are, because when you say don't mention it, I wrote it down. It's in my book. Thanks. Meaning is if you say you're welcome, bring thank you. You're welcome. It's finished. We each move on to the next things. Don't mention it means that I wrote it down. I'm going to get back to it. Don't worry. Or ain't bad, ma. There's nothing. Nah. There's nothing. It's nothing.
It's insulting.
Right. He said very, very much. He's very against that. He said so too. Person says they're sorry. They're finished. That's it. It has to be forgotten from your mind. Right? That's the goal. The goal is that once there's been reconciliation, it has to be forgotten for the mind. That's this violation. It cannot be brought up again in the conversation.
Rabbi, there are people who are angry about something for years and years and years.
Never.
That's the yeah. problem.
You're right?
Yes.
You're right?
It works for them.
You're right. It's their, there's a few reasons why they do that. One of it is power.
Intention.
One of it is power. And one of it is that very often the debt, this we've talked about in the past, any person that owes somebody something in a large amount mm-hmm. will create at some point, not everybody, but many times this is the case, they'll create at some point a condition in order to even the playing field. Right? So you can have people, someone in the shul, I gave this sermon and then someone came over to me and told me this following story. That they brought over somebody, right, that they had somebody live in their house, a cousin lived in their house for 6 months. A husband and wife lived with this other couple that came in, came here, and lived 6-7 months with them in their house, right? And then the person created something, he says, until this day, they're never quite sure, said, you insulted me, and right, once they were able to move out, right, I mean, they're able to move out, to move into their own apartment, then they said, like, you insulted me, and they never spoke to him, 20 years already. He says he tried to invite them to the part, to the simchas. He said, I'm sorry. He says, I never know what it did, but I said, I'm sorry. Yeah. The answer is that has to do with debt. If you owe something to somebody, see, some people, it's hakaras hatov. So some people, you say gratitude, and you carry that gratitude the rest of your life. Right? Mm-hmm. The Torah's way. Meaning you always should have the gratitude in your heart for the good that they did for you. So some people, they cannot live with that. They just can't. I mean, I've seen that. They just cannot. Mm-hmm. So therefore, what they do is they create some cockamamie excuse in order to even the playing field. Wow. Right? And that's a never. That's a never.
Yeah, it's
like, everybody should have a fantastic day.
It's like my mother's family. She was a little girl that was living in Russia. It was before the First World War. Her father bought two tickets, one for her. The idea was her father would come to India, would take one of the kids. She had an older sister and a younger brother. Take one of the kids with him to come to America, earn money, and bring everyone else. So her father had two tickets to go to leave her a ship in Bremen. She lived in Odessa, near Odessa. Her sister was supposed to go, her older sister, who was about 5-6 years older than her. She was like 8 years old. Her sister at the last minute chickened out. And her father had these two tickets.